chapters 9 through 13 of 2 Kings. In 1 Kings, chapter 19, God told Elijah about three people other than himself who would play a major role in defeating Baal. And we had a lesson on that. Those three people, as you recall, were Elisha, Hazael, who would be king of Syria, and Jehu. And by chapter 9, we still await the arrival of only the third, Jehu. Everyone else has shown up. We've seen Elisha, of course. He's replaced Elijah. Hazael is now king of Syria. So the only one that remains to arrive from 1 Kings 19 is Jehu, and he will arrive in this chapter with a vengeance. Following the death of Naboth and at his vineyard in the hands of Ahab and Jezebel, God told Ahab through Elijah that that Ahab's entire family would be obliterated. So far, that has not happened yet either. Jezebel is still alive. Ahab's son is now on the throne. And in fact, Ahab has 70 other sons waiting in reserve. So that prophecy has not yet happened. And Jehu is about to change all of that. He is about to appear with a vengeance. Elisha appears only at the beginning of our lesson here today, and then again only at the end. But his influence and that of his mentor, Elijah, are felt throughout these chapters. We cannot study the lives of Elisha and Elijah without considering these chapters, because these chapters wrap up the things that they were doing and the characters they were dealing with. Chapter 9, verses 1 through 13. Jehu becomes king. In 1 Kings 19, 15 through 17, God told Elijah to anoint Jehu king of Israel. But Elijah never did that. Instead, that job fell to Elisha. But in fact, we're about to see Elisha does not do that. Instead, Elisha sends his servant to anoint Jehu king of Israel. And he tells the servant to anoint Jehu and then run for his life. Why the great reluctance to meet Jehu? Well, as we'll soon discover, he has a rather nasty temper. So apparently that was true even before he was anointed king. So Elisha asked one of his students to go to Ramoth Gilead and anoint Jehu king of Israel. Now, Jehu was a commander in the army of King Hazael. I'm sorry, not Hazael, Joram, King Joram. The student is told to do this privately and then to flee as soon as it's done. We're not told why Elisha didn't do this himself, but perhaps he would have been too conspicuous. Everyone knew who Elisha was. Apparently, Elisha wanted this young prophet to sneak in, sneak out, and not be noticed. In Jewish tradition, not surprisingly, this young prophet is identified as Jonah. Jonah pops up all the time in Jewish tradition, and they think that this was Jonah. The student goes, finds Jehu, anoints him king. But instead of fleeing immediately, which, by the way, makes me think it might not have been Jonah, he first gives Jehu a short sermon. He tells Jehu that his rise to power will come as a result of Elijah's prophecies about Ahab and Jezebel. He tells him, you're going to rise to power, and then you're going to avenge the blood of Jezebel, of Ahab. You're going to be the one to obliterate the family of Ahab. You're going to be the one that causes Jezebel to be eaten by dogs. So he tells Jehu why God has done this for him, why he's going to be king. Interestingly, Jehu was the only northern king to ever have been anointed. None of the others were anointed. And not only was Jehu anointed, but we found that back in 1 Kings that God wanted him specifically to be anointed. I think we know that God has plans for this new king. He wants him to do something. After this young prophet runs away, Jehu's servants, perhaps seeing his oily head, ask him what this madman wanted. And at first, Jehu is reluctant to tell them what happened, but eventually he does tell them. And they immediately start shouting, Jehu is king! Jehu is king! But he still had a lot to do if those shouts were to be anything but wasted breath, because he was king in a name only, I guess, at this point. There was still another person who thought he was king, and that was Joram. For now, Elisha fades from the scene. He will briefly and very dramatically emerge at the end of our lesson today. but the bulk of his work is now over. Verses 14 through 29, Jehu kills two kings. One commentator wrote, "Few events in the history of the divided kingdom are as momentous as Jehu's purge of the political and religious leaders of Israel and Judah." Quite as momentous, and I would add, quite as complete. It was not uncommon for a king of Israel to come to power by murdering his successor to the previous occupant of the throne. Jehu, however, goes one better than that. He comes to power by assassinating not one king, but two kings. And in doing so, he creates an unprecedented power vacuum. He killed both the kings, the north and the south. King Joram had been defending Ramoth-Gilead against King Hazael of Syria. But he had been wounded. And so he'd gone to Jezreel to recover. That's where King Joram was. And Jezreel recovering while his army and Jehu were all over here in Ramoth-Gilead. Well, what does Jehu do? He first makes sure no one can leave Ramoth-Gilead. He does not want anyone going to war on King Joram. So he makes sure they all stay there. Then he takes off for Jezreel to meet up with the king himself. And at the same time, the king of the south, King Ahaziah from the south, decides he wants to go up and visit the northern king. So we have people converging on Jezreel. Well, Jehu's chariots are spotted from the watchtower heading toward Jezreel. They can see him coming. Interestingly, they say that they know he's coming because he's driving furiously. Jehu is driving furiously. It can only be Jehu, they say. I promised my co-teacher I would say nothing about driving furiously. But they almost got your name right. So Jehu is driving furiously. And they see him coming. They send a watchman out to meet him and find out what the problem is. And the watchman ends up joining the company. So they see the watchman go out, they see the watchman get in line and keep coming. They send a second watchman out. He also joins the company. They're all coming in. All right, well, King Joram wants to know what's going on here. I don't think he's fearful at all at this point. These are his own soldiers. And in fact, he probably just wants to know what's going on. Perhaps Ramoth-Gilead was taken. Perhaps these are the only thing. This is the only thing that remains of his whole army. He probably wants to know what's going on here. So the king goes out to meet them and find out for himself why Jehu is coming in so furiously. And they meet at one of the most infamous places in the Bible. They meet at Naboth's vineyard. Naboth's vineyard. That's where this whole prophecy really started off. This is why Ahab's family is about to be wiped out because of the events that occurred there. And that's where they meet. The king meets up with Jehu and says, "Is it peace?" And Jehu responds in verse 22. "What peace, as long as the harlotries of your mother Jezebel and her witchcraft are so many?" The term harlotries here is the Bible's standard metaphor for Israel's abandonment of God in favor of false idols. And witchcraft refers to the false cults that were linked with demons and certainly linked with Jezebel. Say what you will about Jehu and his methods. He knew one thing that many of us today would be wise to learn, and that is that God does not want us to seek peace at any cost when that cost is disobedience to his word. There is some cost for which peace is just too costly for peace. And sometimes, at some point, we just need to stand up like Jehu and say, "How can there be peace when you're doing this?" And that's what Jehu tells the king. Well, the king finally wakes up to the danger he's in. And he tries to warn Ahaziah, the other king, that he come to visit him from the south. But it's too late. Jehu shoots this King Joram through with an arrow and leaves his body to rot in the field of Naboth, the source of the curse, the prophecy that is now being fulfilled on the house of Ahab. Well, Ahaziah, the visitor from the south, watching all of this, suddenly decides, maybe I've outstayed my welcome here, and he decides to head back to the south. But again, it's too late for him also. Jehu shoots him through. He escapes, but he's been shot, and he soon dies. And his body is carried back to Jerusalem and buried. Jehu has single-handedly assassinated the kings of the northern and southern kingdom and has himself become king of the northern kingdom. Why did Jehu kill the king from the south? Probably because Ahaziah's mother was Athaliah, who was the daughter of Jezebel. And Jehu knew then that that meant the houses had intermingled, and some of the southern kings and the sons of the southern kings could possibly have a claim to the throne in the north because the blood had intermingled through marriage with Jezebel's daughter. So I think Jehu knew, I need to get rid of this guy too. And if I meet up with any of his family later, I need to get rid of them. And in fact, that happens in just a few verses. Verses 30 through 37. After killing the kings of both the northern and southern kingdoms, Jehu now turns his attention to Jezebel. The reader has known for quite some time that Jezebel's days are numbered, and it's here that she finally meets her much-anticipated end. Jehu enters the city of Jezreel and finds Jezebel all painted up, we're told, and looking out a window waiting for him to show up. And she asks him, "Is it peace, Zimri, murderer of your master?" Commentators disagree on why Jezebel got all dressed up for Jehu. Some suggest she was trying to seduce him. Others suggest she just wanted to die looking like a queen. Others suggest she was attired as a prostitute to honor the fertility cult of Baal. If she was trying to seduce him, she got off to a really bad start with that crack about Zimri, because he was the ineffectual, short-lived usurper of Elah's throne in 1 Kings 16, and he reigned for 7 whole days after killing his master. And that's what she's suggesting. You're just going to be another Zimri. You may be around for 7 days, but then you're out of the picture. Well, Jehu doesn't like that. He sees her eunuchs up there, and he asks them to toss her out the window, which, interestingly, they do without hesitation. And she falls to the ground and is trampled underfoot by Jehu. Well, after killing Jezebel, Jehu decides it's time for dinner. So he goes off to eat. But he's not the only one eating dinner, because the dogs are also eating their dinner. Later, he commands his servants to bury Jezebel because he says she was a queen's daughter, he says. But again, it's too late. As prophesied, the dogs have eaten all but the skull and the feet and the palm of her hands. So in fact, according to prophecy, as prophesied, the dogs have eaten Jezebel and she is no more. Chapter 10. In addition to Jezebel's demise, we've also known for some time that Ahab's family would eventually be wiped out. And that prophecy is also fulfilled by Jehu. One final obstacle that remains in his rise to power are the 70 descendants of Ahab that live in Samaria. So Jehu writes a letter to the guardians of these 70 sons of Ahab, and he asks these guardians, choose one, make him king, and send him out. Well, the guardians are understandably afraid, and they don't want to make anyone king. But they tell Jehu in response, we're not going to make anyone king, but we'd be very, very happy to do whatever you want us to do. Wink, wink. So Jehu says, fine, send them a second letter. Kill them all, and send me their heads, all 70. Which, again, they do, apparently, without hesitation. Jehu takes the 70 heads of the sons of Ahab and piles them up in 2 heaps outside the city gate. And then Jehu tells the inhabitants of the city of Jezreel, with the 2 heads, piles of heads piled up. He tells them in verses 9 through 10, you're righteous, meaning you're fair-minded. Indeed, I conspired against my master and killed him, but who killed all these, he says. Jehu is using these piles of heads as evidence of God's approval of his own rise to power. Jehu, he says, I killed the king, I'll admit to that, but others killed his sons. This would be God's work, killing the sons, and it was according to God's prophecy. But Jehu is leaving a bit of a false impression here, saying, I had nothing to do at all with these gruesome deaths. He's the one that wrote the letter. He's the one that commanded that it be done. Notice how all this letter writing compares with Jezebel's letter writing in killing Naboth. Interesting parallel there between the letter writing. Finally, Jehu murders Ahab's priest in addition to his sons, and we're told he murders Ahab's closest friends in addition to his sons, going for neither the first time nor the last time a little further than the prophecy required. In fact, Jehu's killings, as we're about to see, I think exceed reform and become atrocities, and that may have been what the prophet Hosea we're talking about in chapter 1, verse 4 of his book, when he says God will avenge the bloodshed of Jezreel on the house of Jehu. So I think Jehu went a little further here in some of these killings than God had intended for him to do. Chapter 10, verses 12 through 17. As before, Jehu is not content with killing members of the royal family from the northern kingdom. In addition, he now avails himself of an opportunity to kill relatives from the southern kingdom. So Jehu leaves Jezreel for Samaria, and on the way he meets up with brothers of the dead king Ahaziah, who he just shot through and killed, and he meets up with some brothers of the king. And apparently these brothers had not heard the bad news. They tell Jehu they've come to greet the sons of the king and the sons of the queen mother. Well, Jehu first takes them all alive, probably to question them, and then guess what? He has all 42 of them killed. Killed all of these brothers of the now dead king Ahaziah from the south. As before, Jehu probably killed these royal brothers because of the mixing of the blood between the northern and southern families. He saw them as rivals to his throne in the north. And he was probably a little suspicious of them. And you know, I think it was justifiable. Because why, after all, was this group now north of Samaria? That's where he met them. On the road, on the Jezreel road, if they were really, as they said, coming from Judah in the south. They seem to have overshot a bit. They were ended up north. So Jehu probably thought, these guys are up here, ready to claim the throne for themselves. He had them all killed. Verses 18 through 27. So far, Jehu has fulfilled Elijah's prophecies regarding Ahab, Jezebel, and Ahab's family. Jehu next finishes the job that Elijah began when he defeated the prophets of Baal on Mount Carmel. And an act of deception is going to complete Jehu's rise to power in completely destroying Baal. In verse 15, Jehu meets up with a very interesting and influential character, Jehonadab, the son of Rechab. The two discover they share a common zeal for the Lord, and so they head off to Samaria together. Jeremiah gives us a little more information about Jehonadab, and he gives us that in Jeremiah 35, verse 14. Where he says, the words of Jonadab, that's the same person we're seeing here as Jehonadab, the son of Rechab, which he commanded his sons not to drink wine, are performed. But to this day they drink none and obey their father's commandments. But although I have spoken to you, rising early and speaking, you did not obey me. Jeremiah is telling Israel, you don't obey me, but Jehonadab does. They obey. They obey. Jeremiah is giving Jehonadab as a good example of obedience to God. In fact, commentators tell us that Jehonadab, they lived an ascetic lifestyle. They didn't drink wine. They didn't even build houses. They lived out in the country. They were trying to get back to the basics. They were trying to go back and obey God and do the things that God wanted them to do. And this appears to have been the leader of that group. And Jehu meets up with him. So we have someone who's a political reformer meeting up with a great religious reformer. And they come together and they're about to march forward and destroy Baal. When Jehu arrives in Samaria, he tells the people, Ahab served Baal a little, but Jehu will serve him much. He tells the people, wow, now we're really going to have Baal. I'm going to go Ahab one more, and we're going to have a whole lot of Baal religion here. But of course, he's being deceptive. But he tells them, the dynasty may have changed, but the religious policy will stay the same, or so he wants them to believe. And he continues, and here's what else he tells them. He says, call to me all the prophets of Baal, all his servants, all his priests. Let no one be missing, he says, for I have a great sacrifice for Baal. Whoever is missing shall not live, Jehu tells the people. But we're told Jehu was not being entirely honest with these priests. In fact, ironically, he threatened here to kill those who did not show up. He was planning to kill all the ones who did show up. He was going to kill everybody. But he wanted to get them all together in one place, which is what he does. They all arrive up, and we're told they fill up the temple of Baal. And Jehu, perhaps, it was Jehu, it was certainly someone, offers a sacrifice to Baal. And once that's over, Jehu ordered 80 men who were waiting outside to kill everybody inside. They also burn down the pillars, they tear down the temple, and they turn it into a refuse dump, which we're told is what it remains to this day. That is the day at which the book was written. Jehonadab's presence here at this scene indicates Jehu's continuing desire to convince his new ally that he's serious about religious reform. Now, the Hebrew does not necessarily tell us who actually offered the sacrifice, although many of the English translations say Jehu did, and that may very well have been the case. But someone offered the sacrifice, and once it was done, in they all rushed, and they killed them all of the servants of Baal. This temple where this occurred was built by Ahab, and it's mentioned in 1 Kings 16:32. Jehu turns it into a refuse dump, which most commentators agree refers to a latrine. That's what happened to the temple of Baal. Verse 28 says, "Thus Jehu destroyed Baal from Israel." He has finished what Elijah began. And we were told way back when that, in fact, Elijah was told. Remember, he was all upset because Jezebel chased him down south. And God told him that it will happen. Baal will be destroyed. But you may not be the one that does it, Elijah. There's going to be these three other people, Elisha, Hazael, and Jehu. And now we've seen them all working together with Jehu finally putting the nail in the coffin of Baal. And Baal is no more. Verses 28 through 36. "Although he started off well, Jehu's reign became a great disappointment. And with the decline of the king came the decline of his kingdom, as God began to reduce the size of the northern kingdom by foreign invasion. And despite Jehu's central role in the fulfillment of God's prophecies regarding Ahab's family, verse 29 tells us that Jehu did not turn from the sins of Jeroboam or from the golden calves that were in Bethel and Dan." Jehu, in effect, expelled the foreign religion of Baal in favor of the long-standing Israelite state religion of Jeroboam, which was not the religion of God. It was the religion of Jeroboam. Jehu did not operate out of Elijah-like motives. If the reform helped him on his rise to power, then Jehu was all in favor of that reform. But if the reform would have had the opposite effect, then Jehu would have nothing to do with that reform. And it would have had the opposite effect if he'd started going after the people's high places and the state religion of Jeroboam. So he did not try to get rid of that. Ultimately, Jehu was like Syria, was like Assyria, and was like Babylon, because all of those had been used as instruments of God to punish Israel, but they were not friends of God. God had used them to punish Israel and to fulfill his prophecies, and ultimately Jehu was like them. Jehu had taken Israel back to where it was before Ahab and Jezebel, but he had not taken it back far enough. He had not taken Israel back to the Lord. He had just taken it back to the other false religion, the one of Jeroboam. And this is a perfect illustration of the difference between restoration and reformation. Protestant denominations today are a product of the Reformation movement, which sought to reform and change the Catholic Church. Yet that movement ended up simply replacing one departure for other departures, just as Jehu replaced Baal with Jeroboam. The Lord's Church, of which we are members, is not a denomination. It's not a product of the Reformation movement. In fact, it's not a product of the Restoration movement in the sense that it originated with the Restoration movement. The church that we're members of was originated by God in the first century on the day of Pentecost following the resurrection. We're not Protestants. We're not trying to reform the Catholic Church in the sense that we want to be some reformation of the Catholic Church. We want the Catholics and everybody else to go back to the original model, the restoration, just as Jehu should have pointed people back to the source, the covenant they were to follow, rather than take them back only as far as Jeroboam's false religion. Why, if Jehu did nothing to remove these false idols, is he said in verse 30 to have done what is right in the eyes of the Lord? This is surprising, because apart from this one verse, the Hebrew word for right used here is used previously only when speaking of David and the relatively good non-idolatrous kings of Judah. So why is that word used positively here of Jehu? And you know, it's even more surprising that Jehu here receives a David-like dynastic promise, because it's said here his descendants will sit on the throne to four generations. Jehu, four generations of descendants on the throne. It's not an eternal dynasty like David, but for the north, it's pretty good to have four generations on the throne. Jeroboam, for example, was promised a dynasty like David's if he did what was right. But he did not do what was right. And so his own son was overthrown and tossed off the throne of Israel. And yet Jehu, who now stands accused of the sins of that very same Jeroboam, now receives a four-generation dynastic promise and is said to have done what was right in the eyes of the Lord. Why is that? One commentator writes, evidently the eradication of Baal worship was so significant that for the moment, participation in the sins of Jeroboam paled in comparison. What Jehu had done that is right far outweighed what he continued to do that was wrong. And we know what kind of threat Baal was. Sometimes you hear people say that all sin is equally bad, and in a way they're correct, because all sin separates us from God. But some sins are definitely greater than other sins. Why can I be so emphatic in that statement? Because of John 19:11. Jesus answered to Pilate, "You could have no power at all against me unless it had been given you from above. Therefore, the one who delivered me to you, what? Has the greater sin." Period. Some sin is worse than other sin in the eyes of God. And I think we must be seeing that here, that Jehu did what he wanted to do in eradicating this false Baal worship from Israel. And after he did that, God said, "You have done what is right, and you will have this four-generation dynastic promise." And maybe it was only four because of Jehu's continued disobedience with Jeroboam's false religion. God promises Jehu then that his sons will reign for the fourth generation. But Jehu still takes no heed to walk in the law of the Lord. And as a result, God begins to carve away at his kingdom by using Hazael, the king of Syria. One of the most interesting events in the life of Jehu is not mentioned anywhere in the Bible, but comes to us from secular history. Assyria invaded Syria more than once during the last half of the 9th century B.C. And in fact, in 853 B.C., Assyria's Shalmaneser III was turned back at a particular battle, and that conflict, in fact, found Israel fighting alongside Syria against their common enemy, Assyria. But that changed. And in fact, a more serious invasion by Assyria occurred during Hazael's reign. And that same year, 841 B.C., Jehu paid homage to Shalmaneser, the king of Assyria. And in fact, Jehu brought him tribute money, and he began a pro-Assyrian policy that was followed by his descendants. So we have Syria, we have Israel, and we have Assyria. And initially, Israel and Syria are fighting jointly against Assyria. But suddenly, Israel changes its tune and says, "Oh, we're going to pay homage to Assyria. We're going to give you money. We're going to bow down before you." And in fact, how do we know about these events? They're recorded on a black obelisk, which is now in the British Museum, and it's on your handout here. If you want a color version that's a little easier to read, you can get that off the web. Or you can see my sister in the front row who got the only color version this morning. This black obelisk is from the British Museum. And I won't tell you who the person pictured here next to it is, but the picture is about the same age as the obelisk. So I will tell you that. But this is the obelisk in the British Museum, and up here at the top you can see a scene brought out, and then I bring it out a little further. This person down here at the bottom is Jehu. That's the person we've been studying about. And there's a picture of him right there from secular history, dug up in the 1800s in Assyria, right here. And in fact, this describes him bowing down and paying homage to this king of Assyria that we're now telling you about right here. No doubt this made Hazael quite upset because Jehu was supporting Hazael's enemy. And in fact, Hazael was probably most upset by the fact that this obelisk seems to indicate that Jehu did this willingly. He was not forced to go up there and pay homage to Assyria. He just decided to go do that all on his own. Why would he do that? Well, he may have been taking preventive measures. You know, if I can be friends with Assyria, then they won't come down and invade us. Or he may have simply been providing support to the enemy of his own enemy, which was Hazael of Syria. In any event, this further deteriorated the conditions between Syria and Israel. And we can see it here on the the black obelisk of showing Jehu bowing down. Very interesting secular history. Also, confirmation of the characters and the events that we're studying here. Verse 35, Jehu dies, and his son, Jehoahaz, becomes king. And we'll pick up with Jehoahaz again in just a moment. But first, chapter 11. Attention now turns to the south. We haven't dealt very much with the south in our study of Elijah and Elisha, but now we're going to look a little bit at the southern kingdom. Why? Because the events we're about to see in the south have a northern twist. As you recall, Jehu killed Ahaziah, king of Judah. Ahaziah's mother was Athaliah, daughter of Jezebel. And she had much in common with her mother, Jezebel. After seeing that her son is dead, Athaliah decides to destroy the entire royal family. That's her own family. And seizes the throne for herself, which she does. But unknown to her, one of her grandsons survives her murderous schemes. Like Jehu, Athaliah was a usurper to the throne, but she was much more than the usual usurper. She was very unusual. First, this was the only time a usurper to the throne grabbed the throne of Judah from a descendant of David. All the others were all up north. We're down south, where David's descendants are on the throne, who have a promise of an eternal dynasty. Second, Athaliah was a woman, and no other woman ever formally ruled the nation. So she was unusual. But she was not just any woman. She was a queen mother. They were very prominent in Judah. They're each named, except for two exceptions. All the queen mothers are named. Very prominent in the southern kingdom. Well, God's promise to David of an eternal dynasty, it seems to be just barely alive here. In fact, we've got one small child that has been saved from Athaliah's scheming that this promise is hanging on. Was the house of David about to suffer the same fate as the house of Ahab? Could these two houses have become so intermingled that God had decided to destroy them both? No. If Athaliah had succeeded, she would have destroyed the messianic line. But of course she could not succeed. The house of David was in a very different position with God than were the royal houses of the northern kingdom. Interestingly, this is not the only time when God's promises hung by the slender thread of a baby boy whose life was threatened by wicked rulers. We think back to Moses, we think ahead to Christ. Jehosheba, the sister of the dead king, takes her son Joash and hides him with a nurse so that he escapes death at the hands of his wicked grandmother. And he remains hidden for 6 years while Athaliah reigns as queen. In verse 4, Jehoiada, who we find out in verse 9 is a priest, brings out the 7-year-old and shows him to the captains of the guard there. He tells them to protect the young king, which they do. They bring him out. They place a crown on his head. They give him the testimony. They anoint him king. They shout, "Long live the king!" Joash is swept to power in a movement that we see popular support, religious support, the priest, Jehoiada, the military support, the captains, everybody wants Joash to be king. Apparently, Athaliah's reign had not been too popular, and I'm sure we're all surprised by that. Notice that Joash here was given a copy of the covenant, of the testimony, it says, at his coronation. Do you know that passage is the basis for the British custom of presenting the monarch with a Bible at his or her coronation service? That's why they do that. Athaliah shows up here at the temple. She sees this young king, her own grandson, sees all the people of the land rejoicing, and she shouts, "Treason! Treason!" So Jehoiada the priest orders her to be taken outside the temple and killed. He doesn't want her killed in the temple. So they take her out, they kill her, and the usurper has experienced her own usurpation. So the priest then makes a covenant between the Lord, between the king, the people, that they should all be the Lord's people. And the people then tear down the temple of Baal, and they kill the priest of Baal. So Baal is destroyed in the south as well. Judah has survived an invasion of northern royalty, It survived a turn to Baalism, which came from the north like a virus through Athaliah. And it even survived a temporary overthrow of David's dynasty through Athaliah, because Joash, of course, continued David's line on the throne. Chapter 12, we see Joash repairing the temple. Although he became king when he was only seven, he turned out to initially be a good king, primarily, no doubt, due to his wise advisor, the priest who had put him in power. In fact, verse 2 tells us he did what was right all the days in which Jehoiada the priest instructed him. So as long as this priest was around, Joash seemed to do what was right. But even so, we're told, the high places were not taken away. The people still sacrificed and burned incense on the high places. Over and over in this book, we're told that despite whatever good may have been happening, the people and the king continued steadfastly in their removal to remove the high places where they offered these sacrifices to false gods. Each time, we're told, they did such and such, but they still sacrificed on the high places. And it must cause us all to ask ourselves, do we have our own high places? Are there things in our lives that we know they're wrong, but we steadfastly refuse to remove them from our lives? Does God look down at us and say, yeah, so-and-so, he's done well in this and this and this, but he still refuses to remove that high place? Over and over throughout, we see that in the history of Israel and Judah. Joash eventually notices the temple has fallen into disrepair. He orders the priests to collect money for its repair. He oversees the fund. There's an interesting section here, which we won't have time to go into too much detail on, but it represented a major shift in affairs. The king was now taking control of the temple and its funding, how it operated. It was a shift from the priest to the monarch with regard to the temple and how it was dealt with and the funds were dealt with. There's a tragic decline in Joash in the end of chapter 12. It started off well, but it ends very tragically. In fact, remember the priest that helped him on his rise to power? That priest dies, and his son, the priest's son, Zechariah, and finally stands up to Joash and says, you should not be doing the things you're doing. You have now turned to false gods and wooden idols. You should not be doing this. This is Zechariah, the son of the very priest that put Joash in power. And what does Joash do to Zechariah? Has him killed, has him stoned. So that's how tragic the decline of Joash was. He had his own mentor's son killed for proclaiming the message of his mentor, who had now died also. Joash dies in a palace coup, very unusual in the south. 2 Kings doesn't tell us much about the coup, but 2 Chronicles chapter 24 does. 2 Chronicles 24, 17 through 18. In fact, we find out that the coup occurred because of vengeance against the blood of Zechariah, the prophet, the son of the priest, rather, who he had killed for proclaiming the truth. Chapter 13. Jehoahaz, the son, as we've already mentioned, of Jehu, has now become king of Israel. This is the first of his sons, and we know he will have a four-generation reign. And that promise begins with, fulfillment of that promise begins with Jehoahaz. And quite unusually for a northern monarch, Jehoahaz seeks the Lord's favor. Verse 2 tells us Jehoahaz began his reign by doing what was evil and following in the ways of Jeroboam, which was not unusual. And God's anger was roused against him, again, not unusual. And God delivered them into the hands of the Syrians. It's at this time that Jehoahaz gets religious and pleads with the Lord. And the Lord listens to him and sends a deliverer to rescue Israel from the hands of the Syrians. Even so, they continue, though, in the sins of Jeroboam. Verse 7 tells us Israel was left with very few horsemen and chariots and soldiers following the battles of Syria. Israel was almost wiped out. In fact, we're told here they were taken into exile for a while. We've known since 1 Kings 14 that Israel would certainly be exiled from the land. But this is the first time that exile is described as an event rather than as an idea. But this exile is not permanent. God sends a deliverer. Some suggest this deliverer was Elisha. He certainly could strike fear in the heart of the Syrians. Another possibility, though, is an Assyrian king who invaded Syria and probably took their attention away from Israel. And that would seem more likely to me, since Elisha is not mentioned by name here. But he is mentioned at the end of chapter 13, verses 10 through 19. Chapter 13 ends with the death of the two remaining main characters in our study of Elijah and Elisha. It ends with the death of Elisha himself, and it ends with the death of Hazael, the king of Syria. So he's not figured in the story since the anointing of Jehu, all the way back in chapter 9. Elisha is still alive. His death in this chapter will end the Elisha era, which occupies over one-third of the book of 1 and 2 Kings. But does it really end with his death? We're about to see Elisha performing a miracle even after his death. By this time, Jehoahaz has died, and his son Joash has become king of Israel. This is a different Joash than the king of Judah that we just talked about. We now have a Joash down here. I should have written on the board under Jehoahaz. This is a different Joash than the king of the south we just talked about. This northern Joash goes to Elisha, who's sick and near death, and he says, "Oh, my father, the chariots of Israel and their horsemen." This parallels what Elisha said about his master Elijah when Elijah went up in the cloud. Elisha at that time said, my father, the chariots of Israel and his horsemen." This prophet, as one commentator wrote, is the man whose prayer is better than the chariots and the horsemen. The prophet, if you trust in the prophet, you don't need chariots and horsemen. Elisha tells the king to shoot an arrow out the east window, which he does. Elisha tells him this arrow is the arrow of the Lord's deliverance, and it signifies that Joash will strike the Syrians until he's destroyed them. Good news. Elisha then tells the king to strike the ground with arrows, which the king does 3 times. That makes Elisha mad. Elisha angrily tells him, "You should have shot the ground with 5 or 6 arrows, not just 3. But because you only shot the ground with 3 arrows, the Syrians will not be destroyed, but instead you'll just strike them 3 times. The problem was not that the king failed to obey Elisha. The problem was that the king did not obey Elisha enthusiastically. Some commentators suggest he used only half his quiver of arrows. Perhaps by holding back a few arrows, the king was indicating a lack of faith in God's ability to save him from the Syrians, thinking, well, if this doesn't work out with Elisha, I'm going to need a few arrows back here, maybe to get back, so I'm going to keep a few back. In any event, probably a lack of faith on his part. He gets some bad news, that he will strike the Syrians, but he's not going to destroy them completely. He'll strike them 3 times. Elisha then dies and is buried. And sometime later, there's a funeral going on for somebody else. And Moab invaders show up during the funeral. And the mourners hastily place this dead man's body in the first empty tomb they can find, which just happens to be Elisha's tomb. And when the dead man touches the body of Elisha, the dead man comes to life and stands on his feet, and no doubt runs away from the Moabites, just like the people that had gone to bury him. Elijah had gone to heaven without dying, but Elisha has kept giving Israel life after he has died. In verses 22 through 23, we're told that Hazael continued to harass Israel. But we're told the Lord was gracious to them, had compassion on them, and regarded them because of his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and would not destroy them or cast them from his presence. Under normal circumstances, Syria would have finished off Israel at this time. All the pieces were in place for Syria to do right now what Assyria would do later. But the end did not happen now. Instead, God remembered his covenant with Abraham, and he spared Israel from destruction by the Syrians. Verse 23, very interesting verse. It presents the promise to Abraham as analogous to the Davidic promise. God was unwilling to destroy Israel in the north because of Abraham, just as he was unwilling to destroy Judah in the south because of David, and no doubt also because of Abraham. But the promise to Abraham was keeping Israel alive, just as the promise to David was keeping Judah alive in the south. Hazael dies in verse 24, and his son Ben-Hadad becomes king of Syria in his place. As prophesied by Elisha, Joash defeats Ben-Hadad 3 times, just as prophesied. And so ends our study of the lives of Elijah and Elisha in 1 and 2 Kings, two of the most intriguing characters in the Bible. But our study is not quite over, because next week we're going to consider the important role that Elijah would have to play in the New Testament. Thank you for your attention here today.
Thank you.